We'll go ahead and get started with the next session of awesomeness. So, hi, my name is Catherine and I am an alcoholic. And I would like to turn the floor back over to our speakers, Jerry from Raleigh and Rich from Ocean City.
Gotta figure out how to weave the word awesomeness into stuff. That's a new word. I like that. Awesomeness. 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 You guys are awesomeness. How about that? Does that work? All right. When I did that first fifth step, I went right into 6 and 7. And looking back on it, it was just kind of, are you ready to change? Yeah, I'm ready to change. And I just kind of did a prayer and moved on. And it looked like probably for me at that time that 6 and 7 was just kind of like filler material on the steps, right? You really don't fully understand the depth of those two steps and the real meaning of them. I mean, I just knew that I had a wasted, busted life, and that I had done a poor job running my life, that I had harmed people, and that I needed to change. I mean, I knew I needed to change. And there were a lot of things about myself that I didn't like, that I didn't want to repeat. And I think looking back on it, I was probably real naive about life and real naive about how hard it was going to be to actually change. And there were some things that I immediately stopped doing. But man, as I stayed sober, stuff would creep back in. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later, but I was told immediately that, hey, you need to go back and make amends for this stuff. And I was told that if you want to stay sober and if you really meant that commitment that you made to accept spiritual help and turn your life over to that power, then one of the main parts of that process is correcting the wrongs that you've done. And, 7-8 weeks sober, I mean, there were things that immediately needed to be cleaned up just so I could walk out the town I lived in. I mean, because prior to getting sober, I mean, if it was daylight, I didn't show up anywhere. I'd go out at night, right? And even, I lived in this little town called Coates, about 1,200 people, 2 stoplights at that time. And you had to go to the post office to get your mail. They didn't come and deliver the mail to your house, right? So, I mean, I'd sneak into the post office at night, to get my mail, and I'd throw half of it away because I ain't paying my bills. But there were a lot of things that needed to be cleaned up immediately. And it was interesting looking back on that. These were things that I would have just automatically assumed that other people were going to take care of for me. I just thought about this as Rich was talking. I was thinking about it. I don't recall. I mean, I almost immediately stopped asking my parents for help, which was part of my amends. I used them and I used them and just continued to use them. And I had bad checks, and that I had to go take care of. I owed people money. And I'm the type of guy, I'm thinking, well, I don't have any money. I can't go talk to them. Yeah, I don't have any money. I can't go, make good on a bad check if you don't have the cash. And I was told that that doesn't matter, that you need to go talk to them and stop hiding from them and make the best deal that you can, make arrangements. Nowadays, we want to get the big pile of money and just go, boom, here it is. And I was told that that's not what you do. You just go and you quit hiding, tell the truth, make the best arrangement you can. And I did that. I went to the grocery stores and said, hey, I don't have the money to pay you, but here I am. I'm not hiding from you anymore. I said, as soon as I get the money, I'm going to pay you for it. And slowly over time, I paid those things back. I had some outstanding warrants. These were not the traffic ones I was telling you about yesterday. These were some different pending charges down at the Harnett County Courthouse that I had been hiding from. And I was told, hey, you got to go down there and turn yourself in. And I'm like, whoa. It's up to them to come find me. They got the warrant, right? I mean, you don't just go turn yourself in and say, here I am. It's kind of a game, right? They got to come find you, and that's part of it. And I was told, no, that's what they did. They kind of laughed at me like that. And I said, no, you got to go down and turn yourself in. And you know what? I went down and there, yeah, that didn't feel good. I didn't want to do that, but it worked out, right? I went down and told the truth and, yeah, took the medicine and it all, you know, I got what I got and it worked out fine. But by taking those actions of showing up and being honest and telling the truth and not hiding and just saying, here I am, yeah, I did it. What do I got to do to make it right? It all, you know, it all worked out. You know, I owed a lot of money. And, you know, again, I'm like, man, I can't, you know, how are you going to pay this back? When you get sober, the mountain ahead of you looks like it's you're never going to be able to overcome it. I mean, how am I ever going to clean this stuff up? How am I ever going to pay off this debt? Or how am I ever going to make this right with these people? And when you're sitting there, you're like, there's just no way that this is ever going to work out. My life's just going to be, you know, I'm going to be just, you know, crippled all my life because of all these things that I've done. And, you know, a little bit at a time. And I had one financial amends, you know, and I tell my sponsor that I don't have any money to do anything. Well, call them up and see if you can send them $5 a month until you get more money. I was told that the act of giving was way more important than the amount. It's just like the basket, you know. When the basket goes around, I was a guy that was told you always put money in it. What if you don't have any? Well, if you got a dime, you give that. That the action is what's important. And I had one of those financial amends that took me 10 years to pay back. I sent those folks money every month for 10 years. Guess what? It got paid off. As I started making more money, I started sending more money. And it got paid off. I would have told you when I first got sober that's going to ruin me for life. I'm never going to be able to overcome that. You know, when I got over it. And it got paid off by taking those actions, by not hiding, by not making excuses. You know, I had family members I had to go back and talk to immediately. And you know, we went and had honest discussions with them. And as I started to take those actions and I started to stay sober, you know, my life started to change. And I'll share a couple of stories with you that more of this happened as I was sober a few years. And when I first got sober, some of my discussions with my family were, hey, you know, I apologize for what I did. You know, I know that I was a bad son or a bad brother, and, you know, this is what I did. And they were just so daggone happy that I was sober and wasn't causing problems that they were like, hey, Jerry, you know, it's okay, it's good, and everything's going to be okay, and we're glad that you're sober, and we're going to help you out as best as we can. And as I stayed sober, I became conflicted with that and realized that maybe some of that was a little insufficient. And I'll tell you a little bit about a couple of those here in a minute. I also, if you've been sober for a while and maybe haven't completely lived by spiritual principles in all areas of your life, you can be sober and really accumulate some damage that's got to be cleaned up when you're sober. And I'll share an experience with you. When I first got sober, a guy took a chance on me and gave me a job. And not long after I was working for him, he actually gave me a part of the business. And I'm sober a couple of years, and you know, I'm needing more money, and I come up with these real clever ways to basically, you can call it what you want to, they call it embezzlement. I came up with some clever ways to do work and to keep the money. And here's what kind of set it off. Well, I do it and I'm justifying it, like it's okay. Other people are doing it. You know, I saw my dad do it as a kid. And I was sober for a while before I realized that's kind of where I learned it from. But anyway, they fired a guy for basically doing the same thing. And when that happened, it kind of hit me that, oh, well, maybe this ain't right. Maybe I shouldn't be justifying it. And I finally made a decision I was going to stop doing it. I haven't told anybody about it. I haven't talked to my sponsor about it. I haven't really, prayed much about it, or I'm just going to stop doing it. Well, man, the harder I tried to stop doing it, the better thief I became, right? And it was this vicious cycle, almost like trying to quit drinking. You'd wake up in the morning, man, I'm not going to do it today, and you get to work, and the next thing you know, you've done it, right? And then you beat yourself up, and you make these resolutions not to do it again. The next day, you go in and you do it again. And I finally got real conflicted about it, and I talked to my sponsor about it. And he had some choice words for me, but anyway, he asked me to write it down, and I kind of did a little inventory on it and wrote down what I'd done and how I'd done it and why I'd done it. And I was also in the process that time of going through me and my first wife had gotten back together after I was sober about 9 months, and we were in the process of basically splitting up. And anyway, I did the inventory on the marriage and the inventory on work, and so I shared with my sponsor exactly what I'd done. And in my mind, right, I know what's coming next. He's something about an amends, right? I'm going to have to figure out how to clean it up. And so I've already devised several ways in my mind to pay this money back without having to tell anybody about it, right? And so anyway, I'm sitting there and I'm talking to Paige and I'm telling him, like, well, this is what I've done. He says, you know what you got to do, don't you? And I was like, what? He says, well, you're going to have to go back and talk to your employer and basically turn yourself in. And I'm like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. And I said, I know this is going to sound funny, but it's true. I'm like, you see right here in the step, it says you do that except when to do so would injure them or others. And I'm an other in this case. You've got to realize that, my God, they're going to fire me. I'm going to lose my job. I'm not going to be able to pay my bills. All right? I'm going to be homeless. I'm going to have to move into the Salvation Army or the healing place. And they might even throw me in jail. Like, it's a criminal offense. I mean, they're probably, man, they might even, call the authorities and want me to go to jail or press charges and go to prison. And he's like, well, you're not another. He says, as a matter of fact, you and your wife are kind of, are separated now, and you don't have any kids, you don't have any real responsibility, anybody, do you? I was like, no. I said, so if you lose your job, nobody's really going to get harmed, but maybe you. All right, if you go to jail, nothing's going to happen to anybody other than you. Maybe you can start a group in prison. Not real compassionate. Jeez. Hell. And so what happened was we came up with a plan to go back to my employer and make an amends. And all I can tell you is I was scared to death. And I wanted to do it because I knew that it wasn't right, but I was scared, and I called my employer up and set an appointment up to meet with him. And while I was doing that, people from the program were praying for me. And I went in and I laid out what I'd done, showed him exactly what I'd done, how I'd done it, talked about the amount, it was a large sum of money. And I tell you, I went into that absolutely prepared to lose my job. And I made arrangements. I was prepared to go to jail. And it was pointed out to me in the literature where it says that usually whatever the situation, we have to do something about it. And even if that means loss of job, loss of reputation, or going to jail, I was absolutely prepared to do that. Because I had come to the conclusion that, through discussions with people, that it was wrong, and that I would rather clean that up than to live with that and live with that burden and to not be right in the eyes of God. And so when I laid that out for my boss, he looked at me and he said something like this. He says, I'd been sober for, I guess at that time, 3 or 4 years. And he said that, I really appreciate what you've done for the, you know, for the company over the last few years, and that you've worked hard and you've overcome a lot of stuff. And he said that he appreciated me telling the truth and getting honest about it. And he said that he had been forgiven for worse. This is a non-alcoholic. And he said he'd been forgiven for worse. And best thing we can do is to learn from this and forget about it and move on. Now I'm sitting there thinking, my God, I've lost sleep over this for 3 months, and now he just wants to forget about it. I'm like, come on, dude, give me something better than that. But you know what? I've learned so much from non-alcoholics. And I've had so many non-alcoholics that have helped me in life. And you know what happened was that I paid the money back. It wasn't mine to keep. So I paid the money back. They didn't fire me. And I'm telling you, man, they had fired people for way worse stuff. Today you could never get away with that, but they kept me on. And he basically just said he wanted me to continue to work hard and continue to do what was best for the company and for customers. And that's what I started to do. And I had an experience right at that same time when I was working with Paige on this, and some of you have heard this story before, but we were reading stuff out of the book, and this was right before I was getting ready to go make the amends. And I told Paige, I was like, you know, there's not a lot written in the big book on step 6 and 7. And if you've ever had an experience, if you think about your life just in general or your life sober, there's you can always point to one or two things that just changed the course of your life. Well, this was one of them. I said, you know, there's not a lot written in the book on step 6 and 7. And he just looked at me and he says, if there was more you could do, there would be more written. And like this light bulb came on, and it literally changed the course of my life. He says, if there was more you could do, there would be more written. Your job is to be willing to change and to give up the old behavior and the defect. And that when you're truly willing to change, that power will show up and help you do that. And, you know, it made sense to me. He says, you can't work on your defect. You got to be done with it. And the more you work on stuff, the better you get at it. So the more you work on a defect, right, the better you're going to get at that defect. That it's that you got to practice the opposite of that. And, you know, through that, at that time, I mean, I was going through this divorce. I was dealing with that work stuff, and life can get dark sober, right? And you start giving up on things, and you start blaming God, and you start blaming other people again. And you know what happened to me was I actually got through that divorce without any argument or contention. It was just smooth. I got through that amends with work, and I realized that, you know, a lot of times when you feel like you're getting further and further away from God, you're actually getting closer, because when you give up and when you truly become willing to change and you have that surrender moment that you can't create, that power shows up and helps you. And for me, came in and healed me and gave me power to actually be a good employee, gave me power to actually treat women differently than I treated my first wife. And I realized that through that process, that really what I was dealing with was, I call it a second step issue, in that I didn't trust and rely on God to take care of my finances. I didn't trust and rely on God to take care of my relationship with a woman. And I'll give you 80%, but I'm going to keep this 20%. And, you know, you can have all that other stuff, but I'm going to take care of my money and the relationship. And, you know, Paige asked me, says, why do you limit the power of God? Why do you doubt that the power of God ain't going to take care of those two things for you? And the only limits that, that there are the ones that you put on yourself. And, it changed the course of my life going through that experience. And I, you know, I came to realize that 6 and 7 are really about giving up and really getting serious about the business of life. It's not about staying sober anymore. It's about getting on with the business of life and actually truly believing that there's a power greater than me that can help me with everything. That I got to bring God into all areas of my life, and that the more what you feed is what grows. What you spend your time on, that's what you become. And so I got to spend less time on being resentful and more time on practicing love, practicing tolerance, practicing the principle of being honest, practice the principle of giving. And that the more I practice those things, the more those things build up inside of me, and that's who I become. And about 2 weeks after making the amends to work, at work, I got a promotion. I mean, it's funny how that happens. Now, I'm not suggesting that you go out and start that you should go out and start telling your employer what you've done the last few months, and magical things are going to happen. But that's what happened, was that I got a promotion, and what I started doing, paying the money back wasn't enough. I needed to change my behavior at work. I needed to be a better employee. And it hit me that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I come to meeting an hour early. I come to meeting 2 hours early if somebody told me to. And I help out. I get things going. I sit up. I go out of my way to be helpful to people. Right? I'm prepared when I chair a meeting. I make sure I'm prepared. I got everything laid out. I know what I'm going to do. I stay late. I clean up. I do things without being asked. Right? I reach out to people. I give people rides. Right? I listen to people. And then I go to work and I don't do any of that. Right? And I'm like, so I've got the ability to do those things. Right? I'm practicing it every day. Except for at home and at work. Yeah, right? So what happened was, to me, was I was like, man, this is pretty simple. You take what you do at your AA group and do that everywhere. And so I started doing that at work. And I had done that a little bit. I don't want to say that I was an absolute, completely terrible employee. I did a lot of work and worked hard. I just happened to, you know, be a little dishonest. But what happened was, that's what I started doing. I started literally trying to, I learned this from Don Pritz. He says, take God with you when you go into the door at work. Don't check him in the parking lot. Take that power in there with you. And I started doing that, and I started showing up earlier, and I started being prepared for things, and I started learning things that I didn't need to learn. I started taking an interest in other people, right? I started doing more than what was required of me. I started doing more than what was on my job description. And I started staying late, and I started going out of my way to be of service. And that was part of making that amends back to that company. And what I can tell you is that over time, that my career started to change, right? My relationship with people there started to change. That little company that we owned got bought, and then we got bought, and then we got bought, and then we got bought. And then over time, I started to get positions that I was absolutely not qualified to do on paper. I became the president of a bigger company that bought us. I became the president of one of their businesses, managed over $1 billion in revenue, had 1,500 people working under me, all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of my willingness and commitment to make the amends to that company and to try to be a different employee. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober about 7 years and realized that through just through living and growing up and paying attention, and you know, I started applying those principles at home and with my family. And I was sober about 7 years and realized I had done a poor job making amends to my mom. And in that, it was just kind of a quick discussion, and I tried to be a good son over those 7 years, and was, but you know, in my mind, why can't she do this? Why can't she be like this? And I would drive to her house, and I'd have all these discussions going in my mind about what I'm going to say to her, and why can't she get over my dad 20 years later, and just on and on and on. And it hit me one time that at about 7 years sober that my job is not to change my parents. My job is to honor my parents. I learned that through a different actual spiritual program, but that my job is to honor my parents. My job is not to try to change them. My job is not to basically what would happen is I'd do the actor director thing. I'd have discussions with my mom, and then I would like indirectly and nonchalantly throw little things in her. Why don't you do this? And why don't you do that? And then she wouldn't do any of it, and I'd get pissed off. And my anger would be just inside. I wouldn't like show it to her, but I would get mad because, you know, well, they're not doing what I want them to do. And so I started to realize that, you know, my job is just to practice that forgiveness and that acceptance with my mom, and just let her be who she is. Right? She's an old woman. She's lived a long time. She doesn't need me telling her what to do. She is who she is. And when I started coming at her with more of a loving, compassionate attitude, our relationship changed. And I took her out to lunch one day, and I wanted to have a more of an honest discussion with her about amends. I had heard Don talk one time, and he was talking about amends, and he says that he knew what he did to people, but he had no idea what it did to them. And when that hit me, I was like, well, you know, that's probably right. And I sat down with my mom this day, and then I just, you know, kind of laid it out. I was like, you know, I know that you know, when I was out there drinking and being rebellious and chaotic, that I caused you a lot of damage, caused you a lot of pain, and I know that I never really gave you an opportunity to talk about that or to say anything to me about it. And I really had no idea what she was going to do. Well, she'd been waiting. Yeah, she'd been waiting for a long time. And so anyway, she went into this long... It was absolutely not mean or vindictive. It was just, she was just kind of just telling me how she felt about, you know, getting the call that, you know, her 15-year-old son had, you know, gotten in a car accident, and they didn't know what was going to happen to him, and getting the call that, hey, your son's just been arrested for assault with a deadly weapon, intent to kill, and we had to go, you know, take him out of the high school in handcuffs. And she told me this story about, I was evidently in a blackout at uptown, at this little town that we lived in, and was belligerent and causing a big scene, and she came up there to get me, and evidently I had physically assaulted her there in the parking lot of the convenience store. I had no recollection of that at all. And you know, she went on to tell me about, you know, how she felt about all those nights that she worried about me, and, you know, and hurting her. And and she finished, and I was like, well, I said, you know, I basically, you know, told her that I regretted that I had to put her through all that. And I asked her, you know, well, what can I do to make that right? And the amends, you know, most of us here probably know that it's way more than an apology. It's way more than just words. A lot of times we think we can say words and it's over with. And you know, she gave a the answer that, you know, the last 7 years, the way that you've been living, that's amends enough. What I want you to keep doing is to stay sober and be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and continue to try to help people. and that the way that I was living at that, you know, then was amends enough. And what happened through that, and what I experienced when she was talking to me, was that she became free. That through my membership in Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to live Alcoholics Anonymous' way of life, that over time she became free. And that by letting her talk about that, you know, and looking back on that situation, I don't think she could have had that discussion with me when I first got sober. But by her being able to get that stuff out, she became free. And I saw just the incredible impact that Alcoholics Anonymous can have on somebody's life that is not a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that, you know, we destroy people's lives the way that we live when we're drinking. We can actually restore people's lives by recovering and by trying to live by spiritual principles. And, you know, in AA, a lot of times we want to focus on me, 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 and we think we do this for ourselves. And you hear people talking about making amends for themselves. And, you know, I had the complete opposite experience that with her, that we do these amends so that other people can be free. We do these amends so that other people can be off the hook. We do the amends for a lot of with a lot of people so that they don't have to worry about it and what we're doing. That they don't have to be burdened with worrying about, you know, whether we're going to come home or whether we're going to die. And it was just a powerful experience. And the relationship with my mom ever since then has been completely different. Right? It's one that is just, it's kind of based on mutual respect. I continue to honor her. I continue to show up and be happy. I continue to stay sober and try to help other people because that's what she told me to do. So I don't have any choice in that anymore. And when she has something going on in her life, guess who she calls? Yeah, she's got 5 kids and I don't know how many grandkids she's got now and some great grandkids. But when something's going on, whether she calls me and she says, I'm calling you to talk to you because you understand. And, you know, for that isolation, and I mean, that's all any of us want. We want to talk to somebody to understand. We want to know that we're not alone and that we're not different. And so, what time is it? When we start?
10:30. You're fine.
Am I good?
Yeah.
Good to go? All right. Keep going, huh? So, you know, it's important for me to remember that if I want to be free, if I want other people to be free, and if I want to take my place in society, that I've got to clean up my past. That I've got to be willing to walk through that fear and trust in God and be at one with the world and be at one with all these people. And you know, once you get to that spot that you've cleaned up the past to the best of your ability, man, you got a rocket engine behind you for life. And that there's, you know, I truly believe that for me, that it's actually the Dr. Silkworth wrote it. He says that we can recreate our life. He says that if our ideals are grounded in a power greater than ourselves, we can recreate our life. That's been my experience, is that by fully trying to apply those steps in my life, that I've been able to recreate my life. One more quick experience here, and I'll sit down and let Rich come up. Maybe 3 or 4 more experiences. I should probably stop right there. It's hard to beat a mama story, right? In AA, everybody, almost all of us got one. But so I probably should stop. But Just a couple of funny things that happened to me. I was sober about 6 or 7 months. No, I was sober probably about 9 months to a year. And I was starting to make a little bit of money, right? And I was slowly paying some of these amends back. And, man, I really wanted to buy a watch. I'd never owned a watch. And I started looking around at some jewelry stores, and I found this really expensive watch. It was about $300. In 1989, that'd be like spending probably $1,000 a day. And of course, I don't tell anybody about it. And I'm still owing people money. And I had my bright idea that I'm just going to go buy this watch, and you know, the stuff can just wait. So I bought this watch. I'm proud of it. I'm wearing it. And at that time, I'm installing telephones in cars, and I've moved out of the shop into a van. I'm driving around installing car phones and vehicles. And one day, I'm working on some cars, and I go to get to the meet, and I realize I've lost my watch. And I'm like, man, that watch has got to be in one of those cars. So I call these customers back, and I say, you've seen this watch. The watch never showed up. So the moral of that is, if you owe money and you want to buy a watch, don't buy a watch. But what happened to me was, now I know I'm a little, maybe too mystical sometimes, but it hit me that, like, man, you know what? I shouldn't have bought that watch. I should have used that $300 to made good on some of those checks or send somewhere else. It was just a reminder that when you deviate from the path and think you got a good idea, that it never works out. I mean, it just never works out. You can't violate a spiritual principle and get away with it. It's absolutely impossible. You might think you will for a little while. It gives the appearance that you can, but it always comes back to you. Always comes back to you. When I got through that divorce with my first wife, I was extremely resentful at women. She had actually gone to the beach with my dad and his wife, and I'm sober, and I can't remember why I didn't go to the beach, but she ended up she met some dude at the beach while she was there with my dad, and I thought that was kind of weird. And she comes home, and she says, yeah, I'm leaving. And long story short was that we had a pattern of that in the marriage. It was just one thing after another, and I finally just came to the conclusion, well, she liked other guys more than she liked me. It just, you know, it eventually became, it wasn't just a big deal. It wasn't a big deal to me. But I was just extremely resentful at women. And I used just that one relationship to judge everything, right? And that one, the actions of one person dictated what I thought about everybody. And I stayed single for a couple years, not quite 2 years. And that's not true, about a year. I'm trying to get my dates right here, but I kind of just swore. Now, if I talk too quick, I'll lie. So I'm sure I'm not the only one in here that does that. And we like to kind of exaggerate the truth a little bit. But I was like, man, I'm never getting married again. I'm swearing off forever. And I'm never going to do that again. And I was just, you know, resentful. And, you know, through good sponsorship and through the power of God and the power of the program, I overcame that. And I realized that it's pretty selfish of me and pretty narrow-minded to think that the actions of one person dictates how millions of people will act. And you know, when I finally got to that place and overcame that resentment, it was like my wife just kind of popped up out of the floor. I mean, like right when I like overcame that, and I started dating. Me and my wife started dating, and we ended up getting married. But I say that to say this, that experience that I had 4 or 5 years sober of realizing that that God's in control and that God's in charge, and and kind of doing an inventory on my relationships and how I treated women, was I didn't want to carry that into a new relationship. And part of my amends back was trying to act different. And I've been remarried now, I think it's 20 years. And me and my wife have a really good relationship. Me and my wife don't fight. We don't argue. We don't tell each other what to do. We don't try to change one another. And I don't want to imply that we don't agree on that. That there's never disagreements on stuff. But we had one argument not long after we'd gotten married, and it was mostly all because of my fear and my selfishness. But we don't have a marriage like that. It's based on mutual respect and love. And I have my amends there in that relationship is I've never raised my hand to hit her. I've never called her a nasty name. I've never cussed at her. And those are all things that's what I did. And I say that because not that I've done anything good, but I say that because that's the power of God. That's the power of the program that I really became willing to do something different. I became willing to let God dictate my actions and my words. And that first marriage I was in, man, I just destroyed that woman through the way that I treated her. And, I've tried to make amends for that. I don't know sometimes people can't get over stuff. And I've tried not to do that. And I've tried to bring the principles of the program into that relationship. That doesn't come from me. That comes from that power. That comes from a willingness to try to be different and to honor that commitment of treating somebody different than what I used to do. So appreciate y'all listening to me. Thanks.
Alrighty, Rich Alcoholic. I think coming off of 6 and 7, into this amends process for me, I was starting to get pretty clear on some things. I was telling you that I was becoming inwardly rearranged. I'm liking meetings I didn't used to like. I noticed you all were getting a lot better. You know how that goes. You know, they're not bugging me as much at the meetings, and it creates the illusion that the others are getting better, which means I am. My work life, I'd progressed from sweeping the floor for $6.25. I was vacuuming swimming pools at the high rises along the ocean in Ocean City. I think I was making $500 a week cash, and it was like amazing. Just mind blowing. And I loved doing those swimming pools because I had to do it from like 4:30 in the morning until 10 a.m. because the pool's open and people like to swim. I didn't know that people woke up before noon, but they do. And you're out there doing the swimming pool, and sometimes I have my shirt off and the sun would be coming up and hitting my shoulders, and the dolphin would be going past in the ocean, and it was just like I was a part of, like, it felt like the world coming to life each day. I'm surfing and being done your job at 10 a.m. and $500 a week. I have no excuse for not. I want to do anything you guys are doing, man. I'm just like, if there's an AA thing going on, I'm all in. I'm in all of that stuff's going on for me. And change it. But the truth about 6 and 7, what I wrote down what Jerry said, if there was more I could do, there'd be more written. I love that. I just wrote it in my book. And the truth of it is that while these defects are what keep me from entering the kingdom, right? It's what separates me from you and God and peace and everything decent, is all these parts of me. I'm what blocks me from entering the kingdom. It's not God. It's not you. It's not any. It's me. I could be there right now, but for me, right? And why don't I want any of these defects removed? Becomes clear, right? Step 6 and 7, they're just so extreme, right? Like, and God does not remove part of a defect. I have to be absolutely, in the 12 and 12, it talks about we've been given an example of what happens when we become 100% willing to have something totally removed. It says, I've been granted perfect release from alcoholism. Perfect release. And then Bill calls it the riddle of my existence, right? Why am I not willing to do this with everything else? You know, well, how about my lust? You know, let's get rid of 100% of, whoa, 100% of lust. How about, you know, 80% of lust? I'll keep, I mean, you want to talk about a boring bedroom life. You know, you don't want to get rid of 100%. I mean, most of it okay. You know, 100% of greed? I mean, what's that all about? I mean, everybody, I grant it, you know, I don't want to screw you out of millions, but I mean, a little bit would be okay. Right? And it becomes very clear as I could go through every defect about me, you know, well, what about honesty? You know, well, I concede that, like, you know, lying is terrible and I want to be rid of that. And but everybody knows that in business, I mean, when push comes to shove, you got to screw the other guy a little bit. I mean, that's how you make money. So I want to be mostly honest. And more than that, I want to be perceived in business as really honest. You know, I don't want to be totally honest, but I want to be perceived. You know, like, I want to be 95% honest. But God doesn't remove part of a defect. And it's just so extreme. And that's the truth of what you're looking at is I don't think that I'm ever going to rise above human. You know, and whether I'm alcoholic or not alcoholic, you know, that seems to be the human condition that we all get to enjoy throughout this journey. But with that said, I had become convinced that life as I'd been living it, you know, was a disaster. That much was clear. And he said, you know, that steps one through eight, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, Roger said, well, now it's step nine. This is where the rubber meets the road. How free do you want to be, kid? How free do you want to be? Well, you know, we got all kinds of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got ground beef, the filet mignon. What do you want? And all the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is up to step nine is it's a theoretical program. Nobody cares. All you are, Rich, up to step nine is you're a self-informed jerk. He didn't say jerk. He said, used a different word. I'm looking at him because that's all you are. Nobody out there in the world cares that you've made some peace with the God of your understanding in steps one, two, and three. Good for you. Nobody cares that you've written out a bunch of inventory, shared it with your sponsor and God. Good for you. Nobody cares that you could, you know, talk a little bit. You're somewhat self-aware of your, you know, defects and liabilities, shortcomings, whatever word you like. Good for you. They don't care. And nobody out there in the world cares that you got a list of what you're going to make right. You've been going to make right your whole life. Good for you. But step nine is where we get to step out there. We get to step out into the world, he said, and maybe, just maybe, you get to die with both sides of the slate clean, both sides even. How free do you want to be, kid? Man, and that lit something in me, and I don't know if it does anything for anybody else, but it did. I mean, that opportunity and that thought that maybe I could die even, you know, that will have been a successful life for me if I could just wipe the slate clean. And he said, the first thing you're going to start doing is dating that mother of yours. Because on my inventory, you don't have any resentments like me. He said, well, I'll tell you a good place to start. Why don't you just start with, list anybody in your life that's ever loved and cared about you. Just go ahead and put them down. It's a great place to start, a fourth step. Anybody that's ever loved and cared about me. And mom, you know, is... Sure, at the top of that list of those that have loved and cared about me, and she couldn't even look at me, and her, you know, head would go down, and he says, start dating your mother, you know, once a week, wherever she'll go with you, if she'll go anywhere, do something with her. And now I got this big-time job with the swimming pools. I got $500 a week. I'm coming to these different meetings. Like, things are starting to get good, you know, and I'm dating mom, and she was going with me, and we're dating and dating and dating. And Friday night was our date night, which bummed me out a little because there's a group where I'm from called the Action Group that's a lot like this group where they do the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they met on Friday night, and I had to miss that meeting, you know, for our date, and my sponsor told me too. He's like, you'll get back to that. If that's what mom wants to date, you're lucky she'll go anywhere with you. You just go. And So we're dating, and you know, that's hip, man. When you're 30, dating mom on a Friday night, it doesn't get better, right? Yeah, right. So, something inside me, you know, I'm happy to be there. I mean, that's weird, right? I should have known something was going on, but I did. You know, like, and after lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of these nights of just sitting and eating and talking a little bit, the most magnificent thing in my life probably happened, which is we were sitting at Carrabba's. My mother's eating spaghetti with meatballs. It's her favorite thing in the world. You could offer her filet mignon and lobster, and she'll pick spaghetti and meatballs, and which is good when you're paying the bill and don't have a lot of money, by the way. And she's twirling that spaghetti around, and her head came up. And she was looking at me in my face for the first time in about 10 years. And we just started talking eyeball to eyeball, mother to son. And she started asking me to come over to her house to take the trash out, because it was getting heavy for her. She got up in age, and it's a little walk to the dumpster. And there's one light in her kitchen. There's one light bulb. It's a little kitchenette with two tables and a little area where you cook and the washer. And you have to get on a chair to change the light bulb. And she'd asked me to do that before when I was, you know, drunk and living that life. And I'm embarrassed to tell. When that light's out, she can't see to cook or eat. And she'd say, can you please come change this light bulb? And it would take me 2 to 3 weeks to sober up enough to go over there to do that. But not anymore. You know, not anymore. She calls, I get to be there, man. And I'm over there, and I'm changing light bulbs, and I'm taking out trash, and we're just talking, and we're becoming mother and son. And I talked about, you know, this whole idea of being a man. Like, I just want to be a man. And what I've learned through this experience with my mother is that it's real hard to be a man if you first don't learn how to be a son. And it's affected every relationship with every woman that I've ever had since. And I'm married for the first time now, a little over 3 years. And when I got here, my credit score was like sub-zero. Whatever you get for having a social security number, like maybe they give you a 300 out of pity. You know, that's what it was. I owed everybody and everything. The IRS was looking for me. I owed them upwards of $37,000. I had a deal with the IRS and the federal government, for that matter. It was like, I don't ask anything of you. You don't ask anything of me. And that's our relationship. But they don't feel that way. They want their money regardless, you know. And so they were looking for me, and the calls were coming and the letters. And, you know, they make you sick in your stomach, and you can only throw it in the trash for so long. It turns out that it's harder to throw bills in the trash sober. You know, that's one of the reasons I had to stay drunk, is to be able to do that. You can, I don't know how you're built, but it turns out that I can fight it all I want. The way God built me, it's real hard for me to just throw stuff away sober that I know I'm responsible for. That wee still quiet voice inside as I reach for the trash can goes, no, right? And I'm like, oh gosh. You know, so that's going on. And as the result of these amends and living this life, we just bought this house that is, if you're new, I'll tell you this is a remarkable learning thing for me. If you pay all of those bills when they come in the period of time that it says, your credit score like goes through the roof. I have almost perfect credit like 12 years later. And that was it. That was the secret. I mean, I wish I had something better for you or more profound, but it's like you pay the bills when they say, credit score up. Don't pay, credit score down. Anyways, that took me almost 40 years of life for that piece of wisdom. And so we get this, you know, spectacular home that we bought the AA way. And what that means for me, the AA way, is listening to. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God. What my third step means to me today is I've turned my will and my life over to the care of God as he manifests himself through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The way that I actually put that in practice is I listen to my sponsor and two or three other men. I call them my spiritual board of directors. You know, if I go, hey, I'm thinking of asking Lauren to marry me. What do you guys think? And the board meets. She seems nice, caring. She's responsible. She has a spiritual life. And they come back to me and they're like, we think that would be a good choice. How do you plan to do it? well, I was thinking of blah, 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 and the board meets and goes, no, 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 no. Ask her mother how you should do it. And I go, oh, that's good. And then I go back, right? And, you know, and the board of directors always comes up with a better thing than I had. And that is a totally different way of living life. And not thinking that there's something so small, you know, that this is my area, right? This is the financial area. I don't need to take that to the board of directors. You know, they're offering me a promotion. Who says no to a promotion? I don't need to take that to the board of directors, right? My brain always tells me that this one's mine. I don't need to take it to the board of directors. But everything that I've done, my track record shows that everything I've taken to the board of directors, right? Whenever I put Alcoholics Anonymous first in that board of directors, whatever I put second becomes first class. And when I don't do it that way, it gets all messed up, right? So I got this house with my wife, and it's right on the water. We could go right out there and surf. Yard with a fence for my wife's dog is why we picked that. Turns out that it's great for our daughter, but we weren't, you know, even thinking about kids at the time. And I could, if I painted you a picture of where I get to live, it's. I so don't deserve it, and it would probably, if you're new, just piss you off, because I hate it when people talk about stuff like this. And but if my mom got to give this talk, you know, the biggest thing that the board of directors and came back on, and if she got to give this talk, she would tell you the most spectacular thing about that house is that my wife and I chose to live 1.7 miles from our house so that I could change light bulbs, take out the trash, and that she gets to come see her granddaughter 2 to 3 days a week. That's what she likes the most about my house. And I wouldn't have come up with that as a consideration in home shopping, right? And that relationship today is, like I said, you know, she's retired. She taught school for 36 years. She could tell you down to the T how many children, first graders, she's taught to read. And she's just enjoying her retirement because she doesn't have to worry where I am and what I'm doing. And if I'm okay, and because she knows. And at the end of my amend with my mother, you know, and all the money that I took and times I burglarized her home and the bail and the lies, and I go through all of this stuff. You know, we always end our amends in the way that I've been taught and the guys that I sponsor with it. And how can I make this right? And then is there anything else that I can't remember? You know, which opens that door for the conversation that Jerry was talking about. And you know what my mother said? She started crying. And she looked at me, and my mother is about as overweight as I am, which is maybe 10, 15 pounds. And she said, all the way through high school, every weekend you never came home. You always slept over at friends' houses. I never met any of your friends. I never met any of your girlfriends. All the way, you know, middle school, high school, when you'd come home from college, you always stayed over your friends' houses. I never knew who you hung out with. I never knew who you dated. And she's crying. And she said, are you ashamed of me because I'm fat? Wasn't even on my radar. And I'm crying, talking to her. And I said, Mom, you've been the greatest mother in the world. I'm so not ashamed of you. You and Dad had rules here. We weren't allowed to drink in the house. We weren't allowed to bring drugs in the house. In high school, there were parents that if we put our keys in a basket, they would let us drink in the backyard or in the basement because they felt that it was better for us to drink there than out. I went to where I could drink. This had to do with alcoholism, not with you, and certainly not your weight. I've never been ashamed of you. And you want to talk about getting free, man. I physically saw my mother's demeanor change. And can you imagine going through life for 15 years believing your son is ashamed of you and you've never met any of his friends or girlfriends, you know, because of your weight? And it became pretty clear what the solution to that is my mom's the cookie mom at my home group. She comes, you know, about at least once a month, drops off cookies about a half hour before the meeting, knows all of my friends. You know, hey, how are you doing, Tom? You're coming up on 6 months, right? Good to go. Did you get a cookie? Oh, Steve, good to see you, Steve. You have what, 20 years next? I mean, she knows everybody in my home group. She comes and, you know, sometimes she'll stay. We're an open meeting. Sometimes she'll leave. But there's no part of my life that's closed off from her. When I was dating my wife and some women before my wife in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I dated for, you know, a while before I found the woman to be my wife. And I'd let my mom weigh in. We're going on a date. We're going to Carrabba's. It's Friday night. I go out with my mom on Friday nights. Come on. It's just a date, double date with mom here. And afterwards, you know, sometime I'd go over there to take out the trash and I'd go, well, mom, what do you think? And I'd listen. And my mom just started to get the freedom, I think, of what every mother wants, is to see their kid happy and to get to feel like a mom. You know, my opinion matters, my experience as a mother, to kind of nudge my son through life. And it's a cool deal. I could go on and on about it, because it might be the most important, or one of the most important relationships in my life. The next was my little sister. I had a set of Ravens season tickets, Baltimore Ravens. When I got sober, I don't know why I had those. I had a black hefty bag with like every earthly possession that I owned in it. And a set of Baltimore Ravens season tickets. I think it was like the result of like one last drug deal. Like, I'll trade you for your season tickets before I got sober, but I couldn't swear to it. I do know that that's just how we are when we get sober. Our priorities are so out of whack. I sponsor a lot of guys. I'm on the board of directors for this homeless shelter in our area. And I just get to be there a lot because of that. And I work with them, and it's amazing to me. They don't have bank accounts like I didn't. I mean, they got nothing, right? They got the same bag of clothes I had, and I'm driving up to the meeting, and they get out their phone. You know what they got? iPhone 6. I'm like, now how is it that you got an iPhone 6? You don't have a bank account? You don't have nothing? I mean, like, our priorities are just so far out. You know, we've got nothing we need as far as life skills and life, but I got all that. I got this other stuff that I don't need that I think I do. Anyways, he said, send those tickets to your sister. She lives down in Federal Hill, which is an area near the stadium. I lived in Ocean City. He's like, you don't even like the NFL, you know, sober. You can't sit still for 3 hours, you know. And I couldn't. I was back into the stream of life. I like playing sports, not watching them so much now. You know, while I can still get in there, I'm going to do it, you know. And I'm surfing again, and those joys and passions are coming back into my life. Because when I drank, that's one of the things that I surrendered to alcohol, or alcohol took, depending how you like to say that. We get into these semantic battles in AA that are goofy. Anyways, I just know when I drink, everything must go. Every joy, passion, hobby. It's one of the things I love asking the guys I sponsor when they're like a month sober. I'm like, hey, I'm going to write you a check here for $1 million. What would you like to do? And most of them can't answer the question. Tell me about your dreams. Where do you want to go? You know, did you always want to see the Caribbean, Fiji, Tavarua? You know, you ever surf Bali? Ever taken your kid to Disneyland? Well, what are your dreams? I mean, what do you want to do? And you're like, we're like, I just sit at the bar, you know, like, and it's because like my hobbies and interests are so far gone in my past, and that's all coming back to me, you know, at this point in my sobriety, while I'm, you know, in this amends process. Like, I don't know a better way to say it. I'm back in the stream of life, man. Love it. And I said, well, these are expensive tickets. You know, my sister hadn't talked to me in 6.5 years. This would be, why would I send these to her? And he said, I'm not asking you. I'm telling you, send the tickets. And I did, and nothing happened. And I went back, and I'm like, nothing happened. And he's like, good, send the next set. And I'm like, whoa, are you listening to what I'm telling you? I did what you said. He said, send the next set of tickets. And I send the next set of tickets. And what happens is that next Sunday, 2 weeks later, the phone rings. And on the other end of that phone is this little voice that says, Richie, 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 did you see it? They just threw the ball in the end zone. The Ravens caught it. They tied the game. The game's tied. It wasn't anything I could have cared less about, man. I didn't even know who the Ravens were playing. But I was talking to my little sister, man, for the first time in 6.5 years. And it was a big deal. And I kept sending those tickets. And we started developing this little friendship around football. And I would just listen to her talk about the game. And it was like learning to talk to her again and to just listen and be a big brother. Because there was a point in our lives up to about 12 where I was a big brother. And she would look up to me and want to talk to me and be around me. And I'd ruined that. Where alcoholism, I don't know if anybody can relate to this, it made my little sister like the big sister. She had to look down at me like I was the drunken kid. you know, and irresponsible. And I was. And there was this really unnatural role reversal type thing. And it was starting to write itself. You know, not that I'm sending tickets and talking to her about football, and the relationship is sort of fixing itself. And then she bought her first house in Federal Hill, and it's like this area of these like overpriced, rundown little row homes, and that need a lot of fixing up. And on Friday, I'd finish my job and dating mom, and then after dinner, sometimes on Friday night or early Saturday morning, I'd drive 3 hours to Baltimore City, and I'd stay with her, and I'd help her paint the place or put down flooring or whatever we were doing, just fixing up that little place. And then I'd drive back, and I got to tell you, like, I was always tired. I never, like, was excited to go paint the house on the weekend. I never had enough money for gas and toll in my mind. And, it was just never convenient. And my sponsor says, if Alcoholics Anonymous is convenient for you, you're doing it wrong. Like, it's not supposed to be convenient. And if I was waiting to have enough money to make any of these amends, you'd have somebody else standing here because I wouldn't be sober. You know, but by going and taking the actions of a big brother, no matter what was going on up here, the feet were being a big brother. And the heart followed that. And after some years and years and years, I get a phone call from a guy that she'd been dating, Justin, and I knew who he was. And he said, Rich, I know your father's no longer with us, but you're the number one man in your little sister's life. I'm calling to ask if I could have her hand in marriage. And I'm telling you, man, there is nobody less qualified than the drunk standing in front of me. I mean, I was a piece of crap, big brother, to give away the hand of a beautiful little girl like this. And Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to do that. And she called the next day, asked if I'd walk her down the aisle, and I got to do that sober and in my right mind and dressed appropriately. And it was, I mean, you want to talk about it, it was like one of my finest moments, man, was walking down there sober with that little girl. And God, when I think about that, it was so joyful. I mean, it was just, you just get to be a big brother, you know. And that relationship, man, has grown and grown and grown. And the best part about that, she's got a little boy. His birthday is this coming Wednesday. He'll be 3. His name's Sadler, my nephew. And she's got another little guy, Brixton, my other nephew. He's 1.5. And I have a 1.5-year-old little girl, Isabella. And those kids, they always come to the beach. And, you know, Uncle Rich teaches them to boogie board and build sandcastles. And all three of those kids play together. And we can all be under one roof with my mom there watching this. You know, can you imagine that? Just like her kids and her grandkids. And there's just none of all that separation. If any of those people were in the same room before, I was going to be in trouble for a whole bunch of lies and all kinds of stuff. And Alcoholics Anonymous has fixed a lot of that, you know, through this process to where we could just be a family. And it's nothing short of spectacular in my world, probably normal in other people's world. And I'm paying the IRS a little bit of money towards this. We drove to Baltimore. It's, again, 3 hours to meet with the IRS. I'm sure they're going to lock me up. And he's sponsor on the way. He's telling me about the principle of the goose that lays the golden egg. He goes, they don't lock up the goose that lays the golden egg. They're not going to lock you up, stupid. They want their money. You know, they lock you up, you're not giving any money. Oh, they're going to lock me up. Shut up. You know, and we get there and I go in and, you know, which is funny now because I now know people that, you know, owe a lot more than that $37,000 to the IRS, and like, they just don't lock anybody up if you're trying to pay something, you know, but I didn't know that at the time. I was sure I was done for. And they put me on this $20 a week payment plan. I have no idea how you pay $37,000 $20 at a time. Because I had a plan. And my plan was like every other alcoholic I've ever talked to. When I had $37,000 extra dollars, I was going to give it to the IRS. Right? The problem is I never have $37,000 extra dollars. And my experience is, you know, when I got free, because those letters that come in and those phone calls and all that, that's why alcoholics have to have caller ID. You got to look at that stuff because we got to hide from a lot of people. Are there certain calls I can take and not take? I got to evaluate. Do I answer this one? Do I not answer this one? You know what that's called? Living in bondage of self. And I don't have time to get into all that, but you could talk to your sponsor. If you got to look at caller ID before you answer the phone, one of the neatest freedoms of my life today, and there's several of you in here that call me, you know how I answer the phone. Hello, Rich Bruckner. Because there's nobody that I'm hiding from in the world today. Came in here with warrants in three states and a whole lot of people looking for me. Don't know anybody a cent. Guy that's standing in front of you, don't know a person in the world a cent, and nobody's looking for me. That doesn't mean everybody likes me. It just means they're not looking for me, right? And that's amazing to be able to answer the phone like that. And that went on for, I think, 6 years with the IRS and until they got paid. And as my jobs progressed, I was able to pay more, the same as we heard. The neatest thing, my sponsor's in the hospital right now. He's got a pacemaker and a bad heart and congestive heart failure. And the doctors say he's got a bad heart. I think he's got the biggest heart in Alcoholics Anonymous because he helped save my life and delivered this message to me and walks the journey with me. So I think it's a pretty terrific heart. But maybe he's given so much of it away that it's starting to fail him. And that's where he is right now, actually. But he went to the post office for that last payment to the IRS, and we're right in downtown Ocean City, and the post office is like the center hub of town. And I put that last check into the IRS with him standing there, and he's about this big and, you know, pushing 80 years old. And he said, "Say it out loud to the mailbox, say it out loud." And I put that check in, and I said, "My amends to the IRS is complete." Right? And he jumps up over that mailbox, and we did this high five, me and my little old sponsor. It was something else. You'd have thought he was Jordan. And about a year later, man, I got this envelope from the IRS. I was thinking there was like a big check in it. And I knew that I screwed something up and I was going to jail. And I drove the 20 minutes up to his house. And I'm like, "I don't know what I did wrong. They sent this. And what is all this stuff?" And he looked at it. And he's like, "That's called a tax return, dummy. Normal people get these every year." And so I've been getting them every year from the IRS. I pay them. They give some back. It's changed the nature of the way that I interact with the IRS. It's not bad. It's kind of nice when they come. I had this friend named Ethan, and he said, "Ethan's next on the list. You're going to do this one next." And Ethan and I have been childhood friends since third grade, knee high. And we grew all the way up together. And when I was out there in California taking over the world, you know, one drug deal at a time, big shot guy living in La Jolla, he invited me to be the best man in his wedding. And I'd heard this girl he was marrying was spectacular. His father sent me a plane ticket, had me fit it for a tuxedo, purchased the tuxedo. And y'all know I was so excited, man, to be the best man in his wedding. I mean, just my best friend in the world. That I was so excited. Y'all know what I did. I started drinking a little bit, right, to celebrate this momentous occasion. And I got so drunk that I couldn't get on the airplane. And when I screw something up like that, I've already told you, you know, that I'm a coward. And the way that I deal with that is you go on that secret list that has to go onto the caller ID of the don't answer list. Because I know why you're calling. You're calling to tell me what a piece of crap I am. And believe me, there's nobody that knows more of what a piece of crap I am than me. And now every time the phone rings and I'm sober and years have gone by, I've heard that Ethan's wife is wonderful. I heard they had a child and another child. But I can never answer the phone. Whenever I see it's Ethan, man, my guts, you know, tighten up. Y'all know that feeling. It's, oh, God. And, I mean, cause I know why he's calling. I know he's told his wife, you know, what a scumbag I am. He's told these kids about this piece of crap friend that couldn't. And so I call him up. I tell him, "Hey, Ethan, I was hoping I could drive down there. He lives 3 hours away in Baltimore." I said, "I'm in this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that I was like a lousy friend. And what I did at your wedding, there's just no excuse for. And we got this step, man, called the ninth step, where I got to try to clean up the wreckage of everything that I've ruined in my life, or I don't stand a chance of staying sober. I was hoping I could have 5 minutes with you and your father. You know, if you'll see me and talk to me, this is really a life or death deal. I know you hate me. Can I just have 5 minutes?" And he said, "Yeah, you could be here at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning if you can make it." And that was about 9 years later. So I think he had one of those resentment things. And I showed up 15 minutes early and with a pocket full of swimming pool money. And I saw his parents' car, and I knocked on the door, and Ethan answered the door, and his wife was standing by the middle kitchen counter with the little girl next to her, and the mother and father were in the back of the kitchen. And what I didn't see was this little boy dart to me, man, from somewhere. I don't even know where he came from. And he just came trucking at me, and he grabbed a hold of my leg, and he looked up at me, and he said, "You're my Uncle Rich? Daddy said one day I'd meet you." And in that instant, with that kid holding on to my leg and looking up at me, it was as if those scales of pride, ego, old ideas just kind of dropped away. And I had this inward knowing. It was an experience that could only occur that way. That in that second, I'm looking at this little kid and I realized that I'm what keeps me from you. I'm what separates me from you. And if I'm separate from you, I'm separate from God. My stupid ego, my inability to admit that I'm wrong, kept me from about 4 years of that young man's life and all of his birthdays and all the fun activities and everything involved. He's just waiting to meet his Uncle Rich. He hadn't told him any of the things that my head told him. He told him he had an Uncle Rich that was a great guy, that maybe he'd get to meet him. And I did my amends with Ethan, and part of that was we do go down there. I have family in Baltimore. We do Christmas Eve in Baltimore. I do it with my family, and then we go over there with Ethan's family. And every year, Uncle Rich is there, you know, with some presents for the kids and time together. And more of anything, the continuity of Uncle Rich always being there, because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has shown me, the value of discipline, commitment, routine. It's what integrity is built on, is those kind of, you know, routine actions of, you know, they know where I'm going to be at my home group. They even know what chair I'm going to be sitting in, because I'm taught that that's valuable, that continuity of action. If people know nothing else, they know where I'm going to be, you know, on a Tuesday and a Thursday night. And I sat down with this father, you know, after I made that. I'll tell you this too, with those kids, I go down there for their birthdays, and whenever there's a snow day, I'll drive down there when they're off school. And there's this great hill at the Board of Education on a street called Charles Street in Baltimore where I take them sleigh riding. And, you know, little kids are, they don't realize you're, I mean, it's a 6-hour round trip to do that for an hour. And they go, "Uncle Rich, you show up on all the good days like it's an accident, you know?" And, but hey, let's just show up, man, for all the good days. And I sat down with this father, and I made my amends to his father, and I told him, you know I owe you for this plane ticket and the tuxedo. And he said, "You're darn right you do. You owe me $1,372. And I reached in my pocket, you know, and I had my swimming pool money, and I'm getting ready to, you know, give it to him. And he said, no. "You're not going to pay it to me. If you're really a part of this Alcoholics Anonymous thing, you really have a home group, you're really helping guys, any of this stuff you're saying, if any of that's true, what you're going to do is no more than $10 at a time, you're going to take some donuts or cookies to your group every now and then, buy them a bag of that fancy coffee, drunks like fancy coffee every now and then. You know, save the receipt. None of the receipts could be for more than $10. Put gas in a newcomer's car so that they could get to the next meeting. Don't give them the money. Put the gas in their car, right? And when you have $1,372 worth of receipts, none of them being more than $10, you will drive them back to Baltimore and give them to me on that day. And on that day, your amends to me will be complete. By the way, I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 28 years, and I've been praying for the two of you since you've been that big." And I didn't see that coming either. And what happened, if anybody from my home group was here, they would tell you that they ate Stouffer's lasagna. We became an eating meeting for the next 2 years. Stouffer's lasagnas are $9.95. They take 1 hour and 50 minutes at 425 degrees. I would come home from work, go to the grocery store at 5 o'clock. I would get that in the oven at about 5:15 as soon as I could, so it had 2 hours to cook. I would get to the meeting an hour early with the plates and the forks that went with it to put it out there. And you know what all of this did for me? It taught me to start thinking about you 2 hours before I was even with you. I was in and around and with AA 2 hours before I even got to the meeting. I was in the meeting. And it started, you know, it was that shift from, you know, me to you. Becoming a giver rather than a taker, worrying about the care, needs and cares of other people instead of me, to leave work and immediately grocery store, cooking, 2 hours, to the meeting, pull it out. What a gift that guy gave me. And I got to give him all those receipts, you know, and complete that amend, because there's something. When Bill Wilson did his fifth step with Father Ed Dowling, you can read about this if you're a dork like me. I like history. It's in a book called Not God, which a guy named Ernest Kurtz, who is by many think is our best historian, he just said that's the one thing you could say about AA, the sum total of AA. What do those people know in AA? Oh, they know they're not God. Right? We don't really care what you think about God as long as you're clear that you're not God. And but anyway, in there, Father Ed Dowling hears all of the stuff that we're scared about of the fourth step, the confessional element of a fourth step, whatever we did, that we're all scared of. And then Bill's done that. And Father Dowling looks at him and goes, Bill, it's not so much the things that men have done that keep them drunk. It's the things they've left undone. And boy, did that, that was the story of my life. I was almost a good student. I was almost a college graduate. I was almost a Division I soccer graduate. I was almost a lot of things, And those are the things that when I really get thinking about them, and I try to tell myself stories that, I believe part of the time. The book talks about that, how I'm able to deceive myself part of the time, but there's a part of me that knows that I'm full of it. And it's stories like, who needs a college degree anyway? That's for the, I don't know. That was really my parents wanted me to have that more than I wanted it for myself. And I try to tell myself that, but deep inside, I'm bothered by the fact that, I don't know if anybody remembers the show Get Smart, when I missed it by that much. That was like the story. So anyways, that made a big difference to me, if it means anything to anybody. But that was just a great deal for me, learning about finishing what I started and doing an amend, and with the IRS getting that straightened out. And the last one that I had this old warrant out in California that I got a DUI and I had some outside issues in my pocket. And they have a program out in California called the PC-1000, First Time Felony Offenders Program, where instead of locking you up for the felony, you get the opportunity to do this like intensive probation where you had to, it was crazy what they expected. The judge said, instead of locking you up, you have to do 10 meetings of AA. Can you believe that? 10 meetings of AA to not go to prison for a felony. Their expectations were like, whew. And, some urine tests and this and that. And he said, if you don't do this, if you don't complete it, if you complete it, it's not going to be on your record. If you don't complete it, I'm going to give you every day of the 5 years that this carries. Are we clear, Mr. Bruckner? And I said to him what I said to every judge. This is like my 35th judge, right? And I mean it. And I would pass a lie detector. I said, you bet, Your Honor. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm going to be your model probationer. Because, who can't do that, right? And what I had no idea was that alcohol owned me lock, stock, and barrel. I thought that I was, as George Bush would say, the decider. I got to decide whether I was going to successfully complete 10 AA meetings, whether I was going to successfully complete urine analysis, whether I was going to successfully complete, this outpatient thing. I thought that I honestly believed that I had power, choice, and control to make these things happen. Alcohol, however, had different plans for me. And when I screw up the probation, I've already told you what I do. Tough guys walk through the fire. Cowards run away. Every time there's a warrant, I run away because I'm a coward. My solutions to most of my problems are like really worse than the problem itself. Now I've got this like felony warrant and this and that, and it's a non-extraditable warrant. I don't know if anybody knows the difference of those. That means they're never coming to get you, but if they arrest you in California, you're going to go to jail. Like if I got pulled over for speeding in California, I'm in trouble. But in any other state, California is not going to pay the money to bring me back, to lock me up for a DUI. I didn't kill anybody. I'm a drunk, right? But now I'm a drunk that's got about 2 years sober and is into my ninth step. And he says, I think this is a good time for you to go turn yourself in and serve that 5 years in California. You owe them that. And how free do you want to be? And I'm going, whoa, whoa, whoa. Sponsors see things different. It's good to have a sponsor because they just see things so different than I do. And I'm trying to explain to them, by this point, I'm pretty well versed in the book, you know, and I'm going, hey, man, I'm in here 2 years. It says we don't do these acts of heroics. I'd be no good to anybody, locked up. You know, why should I do that? My mother needs me, my sister. I'm a good brother now. My mom's trashed. Didn't you hear about that? By this point, I'm 2 years sober. You guys threw in the complimentary AA girlfriend by that point. It's not the woman that I married, and it never worked out, but I thought she was God's will. You know how that goes. Comes around year two, it's like, and here's a bonus prize, right? And, you know, she's 16 years sober at the time. We're keeping house together, not married, you know, just living together. And I'm explaining all this. You know, there's all these people that need me, the group needs me. And he said, well, why don't you talk to your mother and see what she would have you do? And it turns out, y'all know what my mom wants. All she wanted was a son that did the right thing. And he said, you know, this career you keep talking about, you vacuum swimming pools. I mean, pretty much anybody can do that. They could probably train a monkey to do what you do. That's really not a career. That's a job. They'll be just fine without you. And you know, this woman, she's got 16 years sober. She's got a God of her own. She's got a sponsor in her life. In fact, her life was probably better before you came into it. And this house you're talking about, it's not a house. It's a trailer. You don't own it. You rent it. This is a great time to go do these 5 years. And I didn't see it that way, I will tell you. But guys from my home group, you know, they packed me up. And, you know, I got everything situated. And off, they drove me to the airport. And they're all hugging me. And what I now know is the way that AA works for me is it's a lot like a train. And it's really good to be the center train, the center car in a train. When you watch the news, you know, the engine can sometimes hit stuff. The caboose, if you go around a sharp turn in life too fast, that caboose will disrail. You know, it's the one that gets flung off the track, the newest car. But you rarely hear about anything happening to those cars in the center of the train. They're sort of safe and protected, just kind of following along, those ones in front of me with a couple of the new ones hooked up in back of me. That's a great place to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think it was those cars in back of me that gave me the courage. They had some courage and faith that I didn't have. And I'm the best sharing at the men's meeting at my house on Wednesday night. I'm really scared about going to do this 5 years. I really like my life sober. I don't want to go do this. And those guys, man, you know what those young dudes looked at me? They're like, you're my sponsor, Rich. You got to do this. And what do you do when the guys that you sponsor, you like have more faith in the process than you do? It's like, you know, you're right. You're right. I do. And off we went to the airport, and I went in front of the judge that morning out there, and I had sweat circles under my arms, and I'd been in and out of the bathroom 5 times, addressing the toilet with different parts of my body. So any of this business about faith and fear can't be in the same place at the same time, I got no idea what that's about. I was scared to death and had the faith that somehow y'all were going to get me through this thing. And I went in front of the judge, and I made my amend. I said, you know, I've flown 3,000 miles, Your Honor, to do the 5 years. I just don't ever want to have to drink again. You gave me a very nice opportunity, and I screwed it up. I am 2 years sober, and I realized what I promised I'd do versus what I did, and I'm just here to do the 5 years so that I don't ever have to drink. I'd just like to, you know, get it started. And he looked at me, and, I mean, the guy's head was about to spin off. And what I didn't know was about 46, 47 of you took the time out of your life to write that judge a letter, telling him what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, telling him what my life looked like. Pastors of churches where we didn't even have meetings talked about kids' camps I was working at. My home group, we think it's very important that you get involved in the community in some facet outside of Alcoholics Anonymous so people see that we do more than meet on our own in meetings. You know, we do softball with local kids, all kinds of other stuff that has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous, but everything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. And they're writing letters about my life, and I went in front of the judge, and he starts going through these. He's like, I've never seen anything like this. While you did not complete this probation the way that I told you to, you have exceeded by far the terms. I told you to go to 10 AA meetings. They say you've been over 1,000 meetings, that you're helping these people, you're doing. I don't know what this is, but this case is dismissed, sir. You just go back to Maryland and keep doing whatever those people in AA are doing with you. This is dismissed. And he hit that thing down. And that was the 36th time that I was in court. And it was the only time out of those 36 that I haven't gone to jail. I've never gotten a break. I'm not a break-getting guy. I'm not a prison guy. I always get a weekend, 30 days, 60 days. that stuff. I'll tell you that I came out, I called my sponsor. I said, I'm coming home, man, they didn't lock me up. Tell the guys we don't have to change the men's meeting. The big book study could still be in my living room. I'm coming home. And he said, well, wait a second, hotshot. It's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you can't get a plane ticket home until tomorrow. I mean, you weren't even planning on coming home, right? And I'm like, yeah. And I will tell you that plane ticket, by the way, is in the front of my book. I keep it there so that, because, I mean, that was like, God got a lot bigger in my life that day through the experience. Again, y'all didn't convince me of anything. You didn't sell me your God. You said, take these actions and you'll get your own. You'll, better than that, you'll experience your own. And that's what was happening. And I said, I'm coming home. And he said, you can't get that ticket till tomorrow. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, what about that college? You remember those Jesuits that kicked you out and those newspaper articles? Jesuit student, 27 kilos of cocaine. Isn't that college right near where you are? And I said, well, yeah. And he said, then go over there and get that straight while you're there. And I'm thinking, like, can we celebrate for a brief moment here? Like a major event just happened, in case you're 5 years in prison, not doing that. Did you catch that? Get over there, you know. And the book talks about that it's, you know, action and more action. It's like a pep rally when you read those pages of the 9 steps. Seriously, it's like, go kid, right? And the more that I'm doing that, God's just showing up left and right. And I go back to the university and I ask to see the dean. And of course, all those years later, it's now like 10 years later, it's the same dean that kicked me out. And I sit down and I make my amends and I say, listen, I know that I brought a lot of shame and disgrace to the university and to the Jesuits. I didn't even know what Jesuits were when I went to college here. I now know that you stand for building men and women of integrity and honor and education and a whole lot of things that I wasn't. But I'm trying to become those things through Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've got to straighten this out and do my best. I have no idea how to make this right, but I'll do whatever you tell me to do. And she said, if that's true, come with me. And she walked me over to a building next door that I'd never been in and slapped down a huge stack of papers in front of me. She said, this is an application to our law school. I want you to fill this out. What you're going to do is you're going to go to our law school. You're going to go on to graduate and make us proud. That's how you could fix this. We don't like to kick people out. Believe it or not, what makes us look good as an institution is having a high graduation rate and our alumni to go on to do things that make us proud. That's how you're going to fix this. I step outside. I call Roger, my sponsor. I say, this lady's lost her mind. She wants me to fill out these papers, go to law school. I'm a federal felon. I've been arrested 36 times. Even if I somehow make it through law school, which we all know I'm not smart enough to do, I'm too old to do this. These kids are young, sharp, they're smart. Even if I somehow get through this, they're never going to let me take the bar exam because of my background. Even if I pass the bar exam, the ethics committee will certainly never let me practice. He said, shut up. Shut up. Did you just tell that lady you'd do whatever she said to make this right? And I said, yes, I did. He said, then fill out the papers. And I did. And about a little over 3 years later, I graduated second from the top in my class at that law school. Not because I'm smart, because I did law school the AA way. I showed up a half hour early for every class because y'all taught me to do that at the door. I shook every teacher's hand every day of every class until they learned my name, just like I do with the newcomer. I stayed after class for 15 minutes to ask the teacher a question, whether I really had one or not, just like we do to newcomer. It turns out that that's an incredible foundation for life. Like, we're just trying to get to know you. We're not trying to bug into your, you know, business or anything like that. We're just trying to build the relationship. And it turns out that that principle has served me so well in another many areas of my life. And taking it to work. You know, we just heard about that. Showing up a half hour early, doing the same thing there that I do here, yielded wonderful results. I will share this with you, that my experience with the 9th step is it could go one of two ways. The 9th step is an opportunity for me to clean up the wreckage of my past, or it will clean me up. It can come one or two ways. It's a spiritual principle. You can't stop a spiritual principle. My experience with that, I came back. I got hired as a clerkship for 2 circuit court judges, which is the highest trial court in the state of Maryland. It's a wonderful job. If you clerk for a judge, you write their opinions. When you write there, you do that for 2 years, and you could write your ticket to any law firm you want to go to. I mean, it is the best deal in town. And I'm telling my mother and my home group and my sponsor about it. This is unbelievable. I got this job. Me, you know, clerk for a judge. I'm going to be writing a paper, blah, blah, blah. And a week after they hired me, I got called back to the judge's office and they said, "Boy, we really wanted to hire you. But when we turned your paperwork into the state, you get paid through the state, we had to run a background check, and you have 3 outstanding felony warrants from the state of Colorado." And I had no idea that they existed. They weren't on any step I'd worked or four step or eight. And not because I was avoiding it. It was truly a more will be revealed. And I said to the judges, I said, well, Your Honor, I've already disclosed everything else to you. You know that you're dealing with a guy that's been arrested 36 times. Can I have the opportunity? I'm not supposed to start this job for 8 months. Can I go to Colorado and try to clear this up and figure out what it is? And if I get it taken care of, can I still have the job? And the two judges looked at each other for about 30 seconds and said, well, we just hired a guy with 36 arrests. What's one more? And off I went to Colorado. And it turned out I learned what was going on out there. I worked for a gentleman out there, happened to be a lawyer. And I had the same experience where he didn't pay me. I don't know if anybody's ever had this. He just didn't pay me what I was worth. And I knew he should be paying me more. So I was supplementing my paychecks back while I was drinking out of his operating account. And just paying me what I wasn't stealing. I was just paying myself what I was worth. And but they call that felony check fraud for each check over $500. And I had three of them. And I went out there and I sat down with him. And I paid him the money back that I owed for the checks plus interest. And told him what I was there to do, you know, and what was going on in my life and what my life looked like through Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm on this ninth step and I got to try to make this right. And he said, whoa. You're on step 9 in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know how many times I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous and I've never made it past step 3? I always get to step 3 and I drink. And it changed the course of our visit. He took care of the warrants, man, but that is not why God had me there. And to this day, I wish I could tell you whether he's sober or not. I don't know. I know that I spent the rest of the afternoon outlining the rest of the spiritual program of action like we've been doing this weekend. And I left. He had a sparkle in his eye and told me that he was going to make a decision to go through with the rest of the deal. And I hope he did. And I wish I had a cooler end to the story, but that's the truth. We haven't stayed in touch. But I came back and I was about to start that job. The judges said, wow, man, you like cleared that up. And, you know, I was ready to start. And just as I was, my phone rang and it was a weird phone number. And on the other end of the phone was a guy. I didn't recognize the number, but thank God I could answer the phone. And he introduced himself. He said he was the state's attorney for the state of Maryland. And he had a governor on the other line and that he'd been given a federal grant to hire an assistant state's attorney to head up a new gang and narcotics prosecution unit, and that he'd been given my phone number that I might know something about the importation of narcotics into our country. Would I serve the state of Maryland as their narcotics prosecutor? I'm thinking my knees are about buckling, you know. But you know what my second thought was? All those old guys with that smile on their face and that book in their hand, they always promised me one thing. They said, kids, someday, if you go through with all of this, which, by the way, we don't see many people do, right? That first line of how it works, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. They said, if you're tired of failing, cross off that word, fail, and read it back to me. Rarely have we seen a person who has thoroughly followed our path. And that's the truth of it, for me. But they said, if you go through with this one day, kid, your sordid past will become your greatest asset. And I can tell you that I've served in that capacity now for about 7 or 8 years, where I get to serve the state of Maryland. I stand there at that table. When I look at the defense table, somebody else might see an armed robber. I see a guy that needed a drink at 3 o'clock in the morning. I can tell you that I've come up with some very creative sentencing arrangements in that period of time. I practice law the way that I practice AA because that's what was suggested to me. The result of that is I serve on the Maryland State Bar Association's lawyer assistance program. It's 9 people. If a lawyer's about to get disbarred as a result of alcohol or drugs, they get sent to me to see if maybe they might want to do something about their problem rather than lose their livelihood. Just 2 years ago, I got nominated by the neat part of this for me is it's my fellows. Because of the way that I practice law, which I swear to you is nothing I do. I just took what you gave me in AA and I practice law the same way. They nominated me for a judgeship. I was the youngest person to be put up for a circuit court judge. It just came out. They picked who it is 4 months ago, and it was not me. They felt that I was too young, and I agree with them. And the person they picked is spectacular. But the fact that of 3 names, my peers, all the attorneys in the state of Maryland picked 3 names, and I got to be one of them, you know, a lying scumbag. You know, got to be somebody that they thought could be honest and fair. You know, and that's what you did. And I get to do that at home. And I'm taught to try to treat my wife as I would my favorite sponsee. Treat my wife as I would my best customer, Chuck Chamberlain says in A New Pair of Glasses. Taking these principles into their home, because it's hard. It's where I'm the weakest too. I mean, I'm not standing here like I got it nailed, you know. That's for sure. And there have been times my wife has said, boy, I wish you gave me as much time as you do a dying drunk. And that's a little bit embarrassing, but that's the truth. You know, and I try to, you know, take this there every day. I mean, it was hard, this career thing at first. Judges, I don't like judges. I don't like prosecutors. You know, like God has basically turned me into the guy that I hated my whole life. Right? Like I would have 12 years ago, I would have kicked my own ass. You know what I mean? Like I'm the guy I'd like to beat up. And the judges, they would go in, and in the morning, like those first couple months, they would say tricky things. You know how judges are. They would say, would the defendant please rise? And I'd stand up, and he'd go, sit down. You're the prosecutor now. You know, and I was like, I was just so used to always being the defendant. And now every day, you know, I'll tell you what, I start my day, so the last day I say, we'll get some grub, was, in case you can't tell, man, this is where it all happened for me. I could go on and on and on. Every good thing in my life, every good relationship. Once a month, I have to have a meeting where I get the head of the DEA for Maryland, Virginia, and Delaware together, because that's, you know, 13 is an excellent quarter that comes through the three states, all three governors, all the heads of law enforcement, and I conduct this meeting, which is really like a group conscience. I don't tell them that. you know, who do you think the governor's assistant was from Delaware? Every time I call, she'd answer the phone at the meeting. She'd give him his, you know, cheat sheets, and she'd sit next to him, and it was kind of like what's going on this weekend. They always put the cute chick that really knows what's going on next to the two morons, and that chick, you know, that kind of ran the governor of Delaware, turns out to be my wife. That's where we met, was because, you know, everything good in my life has come from the ninth step. Every good relationship, every good friendship, and a whole lot of fun. And each day I start my day, and I get to say two great things. In the morning, I go into the courtroom and I say, good morning, Your Honor, Rich Bruckner for the state of Maryland. And every night, you know, I come somewhere like this just about. And I get to say what's far more important, which is that my name's Rich Bruckner. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for listening on the Ninth Step.
All right. Thank you, everyone. We're going to go ahead and give us a few minutes to get the table set up. If you have food, just please bring it up there and take a quick break. Remember, bathrooms across the hall, smoking outside, away from the door. Thank you.